Simpson oil users and stuff, the cancer people.
Welcome, everyone. I will convene the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91. Tonight is posted as a work session, and we will be taking up the Senate Bill 844 and the Dash 6 and 7 amendments. We will not be moving the bill tonight, but we will be having invited testimony from key stakeholders to enlighten the committee so that we have one more chance to, if there are further tweaks that need to be made, that we can have time to make those and have another hopefully small amendment ready for Monday. Our plan at this time is to move the bill out on Monday. So with that, I will open the work session on Senate Bill 844. And there have recently been a lot of questions about the residency requirement and whether we're on strong legal ground with our residency requirement that's in the draft of Senate Bill 844 and is contemplated for the future draft on the recreational bill that will be coming. So I've asked Mark Mayer, our hardworking counsel, to enlighten us on where we stand legally on residency requirements. Welcome, Mark.
Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, members of the committee, do you want me to speak directly about the residency requirements immediately?
Yes, put your name on the...
Mark Mayer from Legislative Council.
Yes.
And you would like me to start speaking about the residency requirements immediately?
As opposed to...
The Dash 7 amendments, if you wanted me to walk through those.
No,
well.
I want you... Yes, I want you to walk through those, but I'd like... No, why don't you start off with the residency, and then we'll walk you through the amendments, and then we'll go to our panel.
So the general rule of law with any kind of state law that prohibits out-of-state interests is you have to look at it underneath both the jurisprudence of the Dormant Commerce Clause and the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And underneath those two clauses that are both constitutional clauses, you have a two-step analysis in order to determine whether or not the particular state law is constitutionally invalid. For the Dormant Commerce Clause, you're going to be examining whether or not there is a legitimate state concern and then whether or not that legitimate state concern is outweighed by the impact it has on interstate commerce. For the Privileges and Immunities Clause, you will be examining whether or not the state law impedes or infringes on a fundamental right and then whether or not that state law is rooted in a substantial reason for the infringement. So those are the two analyses that you're going to be looking at here. Usually, when you look at this situation, most times you're going to break and say that a law that impedes somebody from moving into state to start an operation or from investing in a state operation is going to violate one of those two clauses. But we have a situation in this particular situation where you have an activity that is still federally illegal. And because of that federal illegality, it kind of changes the dynamic of how you look at the situation. Dormant Commerce Clause is an easier analysis. Underneath the Dormant Commerce Clause, basically the state interest here is to prevent the spread of a federally illegal activity or to prevent proceeds funneling out of the state that could subject out-of-state interests or other people to federal racketeering laws and things of that nature, and keeping that activity in state, as well as from the direction of the Cole Memorandum, trying to keep the activity completely in state as well, which is the direction that we've received from the Federal Department of Justice. So that would be the state interest in imposing these types of requirements. Do they outweigh the burden on interstate commerce? In this particular situation, you'd probably say, yes, they do, because there is not a large interstate commerce yet for these activities. When marijuana becomes descheduled and it becomes an interstate commerce activity, then yes, you have to revisit some of these ideas that you're thinking about, and you have to redo the analysis at that point. But in this particular situation, it looks as if a court would look at that, I would say, and probably think, okay, the state interest here outweighs the other consideration. Privileges and immunities, we did some more research on this today. There is a court case, if I can pull it up real quick, State versus Beringer, which basically says that, and it's an Oregon Supreme Court case, there is no fundamental right to a particular medication. On top of that, if you look at United States Supreme Court case Baldwin, 436-303, that characterizes privileges and immunities clauses protecting the vitality of the nation as a single unity. And again, we have a patchwork of different states that are slowly entering into this marketplace. And so, again, your analysis begins with, well, do we have a situation where there's a fundamental right that is being infringed upon? There's an argument that you don't, and a strong argument that you don't, until, again, it becomes federally descheduled. Then you have to revisit the issue. Even if a court were to say, well, yeah, there is a fundamental right at risk here, then you would, again, look at whether or not the state interest was substantial in protecting the residency requirement. And in this case, again, I think you have a industry that is federally illegal, legal in state, direction from the Cole Memorandum, and there are strong arguments that these types of impositions would survive judicial challenge.
Thank you. And we have a legislative council opinion that came out that people were concerned about that was more generic. Could you address that just very briefly?
The opinion that was issued on the 20th of this month, or was it last month, I think?
April.
April. That opinion did come out. It was about Oregon businesses in general, and it is a solid opinion insofar as it applies the law to the theoretical imposition of this type of requirement on a Oregon business, without considering the factual circumstances that we're looking at in this committee, where we're dealing with federal illegality, direction from the State Department of Justice, and how to try to comport with those two things. So that opinion is a solid opinion, but again, it does not deal specifically with marijuana operations. It deals with business operations in general.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Well, okay. I guess, yeah, thank you, Madam Speaker. So from the opinion from your office, Mark, is it unconstitutional where we're going?
Again, residency requirements in this context, there is a very strong argument that they would survive judicial challenge. I would argue that we would survive judicial challenge with residency requirements. But again, we are in uncharted territory here, so I don't want to give you the impression that I know exactly what a court would say. However, I do think if you look at the two-step test underneath both privileges and immunities, as well as dormant commerce clause, you do have a substantial reason for imposing the requirements.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
So, Madam Chair, we've had testimony that the desire to make this a homegrown, pardon the pun, industry is one reason why we had imposed this four-year residency requirement. The reason that this has been stated today by legal counsel is that you might find an argument within the Cole Memorandum relative to interdiction of interstate commerce. But I would submit to you that the record that we've created is that it's the desire of the committee to make this a homegrown business. So I would ask our legal counsel to answer the question, what is the purpose of the four-year residency requirement in this context? Please restate the compelling and overriding reason for the four-year residency requirement.
Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, Senator Farioli, I don't want to assume motive on the part of the committee. What I can say, though, is purposes of economic protectionism, there are some court cases that allow that for emerging businesses underneath the Dormant Commerce Clause. However, the argument there is much weaker if you do take out the consideration of the Cole Memorandum and the direction it provides the states for implementing these programs, as well as the fact that we still have a federally illegal activity. Those are much stronger reasons.
Other questions?
I'm just certain that that is as clear to the rest of the committee members as it is to me. Madam Chair, I guess I would call that a rebuttable conclusion and litigable. So I look forward to the litigation that will clarify whether this is a solid theory or a one that would be reversible.
It's my understanding that Colorado has a residency requirement and that it has not been challenged in court, or it is at least not a successful challenge. Is that your understanding?
Chair Burdick, Chair Lining are correct. They have a residency requirement, but it has not been challenged yet.
Okay. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mark, is there any difference if we scale up or scale down on the number of years for your analysis? Say we wanted to impose an 8-year residency requirement. Is that somewhat weaker? And conversely, would a 2-year residency requirement therefore be stronger, maybe, or more easily defensible in your mind?
Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, I think for Representative Helm, I think for Dormant Commerce Clause purposes, that isn't going to be an issue, but for privileges and immunities, it would. And I think that scaling down makes the argument, it makes it easier underneath privileges and immunities, because then, again, the state law that imposes the prohibition or the mandate is less severe. And so the balancing act, when you look at the balancing test, the balancing act is more likely to go in favor of the state law.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Mark, about the residency requirement, now I may be wrong, but I'm beginning to go back and look at Measure 91, and I don't see a residency requirement in 91. What would be the compelling reason, and what would be the compelling reason for having a residency requirement on one, the medical side, and no residency requirement on the recreational side?
Chair Leininger, Chair Burdick, Representative Wilson. Again, I can't assume motive, but I do think that if you have a residency requirement on one side and not on the other side, then that somewhat weakens the balancing test that you would be attempting to argue in court.
Thank you. So just as a quick statement then, if you were concerned about upholding the tenets of the voter-approved 91, you might want to think twice about adding residency requirements on the medical side. Not a question, just a statement. Yeah,
thank you. I wouldn't be able to answer that question.
Exactly.
Thank you. If there are no more questions, why don't you move into a description of the Dash 7 Amendment?
All right. Thank you. So the Dash 7 Amendment, Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, the Dash 7 Amendments were based primarily off of the comments made by this committee on Monday, as well as some feedback that certain members of the committee got from various interested parties. I think I'm not going to hit every single thing that the amendments do, but I will address the most important things that they do. The first thing they do, if you look, it's only two short pages. If you look on the first page, lines 3 to 8 of the Dash 7 amendments, we specify here that OHA's inspection powers with respect to marijuana grow sites, it only extends to grow sites of a person designated to produce marijuana for a patient. So if a patient is growing for himself, then we don't have that issue. And there will not be inspection powers of those sites. On page 23, line 9 of the amendment, we've reduced the records retention period for grow sites from 7 years to 2 years. Lines 10 and 11 on page 1 of the amendment, we have taken the residency requirement for the processing sites from 4 to 2. And the idea there is that we don't have that break-in period of people who've been here for a year already and registered currently. So since the processing sites are brand new registrations, the residency requirement need to be scaled back. Lines 12 and 13 of the Dash 7 amendments on page 1 basically qualify where a processing site can be located, not in a residential area, if the processing site processes extracts. So that would allow the edibles in residential areas. Lines 14 to 16 on page 1, delete lines 12 and 13. That is the co-location requirement for grow sites and processing sites. We removed that requirement from the dash sixes. Lines 17 to 19 of the Dash 1 amendments, we have removed the security system requirement for processing sites. Again, the conversation there was cost and that sort of thing. Lines 20 to 22 on the Dash 1 amendments, we have eliminated the specific requirement that for safety and sanitation reasons, these processing sites are licensed with the Department of Agriculture. And the idea there is if there needs to be some sort of memorandum of understanding between Ag and OHA, they'll still be able to do that for purposes of this act, but the specific requirement we're going to remove. On page 2, line 1, we address Representative Helms' request to require processing sites and later in the amendment dispensaries to send in information to the database so that their transfers will be sent into the OHA database as well. Section 14, the rewrite of Section 14 at the top, this was to address Representative Buckley's concern about the language trying to clarify that designated caregivers and patients weren't subject to the processing site as long as they were doing as long as what was being processed was edibles or concentrates. It should be noted that if you're going to be selling into a dispensary or you're going to be processing extracts, which are the high heat, high pressure type of extracts, those would still have to be done at a processing site that's registered. Some cleanup throughout the next few lines. Lines 14 to 17 on page 1, clarifying that a county also may adopt time, place, manner ordinances for grow sites, which was not in the original draft. Some more cleanup until you get to line 21 to 24 of the amendment. On page 70, Representative Helms comments about the specificity with which we required OHA to label marijuana products for potency. We've replaced that with general language, allowing for more rulemaking ability there to so that OHA have the ability to determine the best way to label products for potency. And then lines 25 through 30, clean up by me in order to ensure that somebody who's been registered before January 1, 2015, but who has not been able to, who has not been registered for a full year, would not get inadvertently kicked out of the system when the intent is those people should be able to be in the system. So basically we're saying that for people who were registered before January 1, 2015, OHA isn't going to start checking their residency until, I believe, January 1. Oh, it's on the next page, January 1, 2016. So there will be no inadvertent removal of somebody from the registry simply because that person was only registered for 10 months even though they were registered before January 1, 2015. Yeah, those are the dash sevens.
Great. Questions from the committee? All right. Thank you. We will now move into three panels of interested parties and stakeholders. So we will start out with a panel of Amy Margolis, Jonathan Matten, and Lisa Nato.
Thank you so much, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Sun-Grown Growers Guild. And I want to just open tonight by saying how much I personally and the folks that I represent at the Guild appreciate each of your work coming into this. We know that you all are coming into this from a healthy spot and trying to do the right thing. There's going to be areas, of course, where we all may disagree on some things, but we wanted to take a second to just make sure that you know how much we appreciate your hard work and dedication to get us to where we are today. And I would also extend that gratitude to your staffs. I know that they are dealing with an awful lot of members of the public and a lot of people, and they're doing tremendously hard work. As a former staffer myself, I want to make sure that they understand how much they're appreciated, as well as, of course, Mark with LC. The Guild, what an opportunity for me to get to share with you a little bit more today. Thank you for inviting me. The Sun-Grown Growers Guild, I had a chance to go down and meet with some of them when this process first started, and as some of you have been able to. They're family farmers. They're patient-driven. They're incredibly compassionate people. They're responsible community members and neighbors, very earth-friendly. It's a very rural area where most of these folks live. I grew up in Georgia. We call it country, not rural. These are country folks, rural people living a rural lifestyle, incredibly skilled with the medicine that they are growing. Incredibly hardworking. For anybody who's been around a farm and knows how hard it is to be a farmer and how much work goes into that. Very distrusting of government, right, as a lot of us are. But from the very beginning, they've been willing to give this whole process a try and willing to engage and want to come into this system and participate and continue to grow medicine for their patients. And from the very beginning, the first things they were sharing with me is how important it is for their patient stories and hearing the impact that they've made with the specific strains of medicine that they've been able to produce in this specific part of the world, in Southern Oregon. The temperature is right, the soil is right, the rain is right. And by experimenting with different varieties of the plant over a long time, they've been able to achieve remarkable results for patients that works. I would describe them as very welcoming. I would say equal parts eager, scared, optimistic, and just worried about how this is all going to play out. But very thankful that we are where we are today. They're Oregonians worthy of our respect and appreciation and support, in my opinion. We've come so far. We started off wanting to protect the grower-patient relationship as a primary focus and absolute need. They were worried about the existing possession limits in the medical program of being a pound and a half between the three potential parties, so that if you had a bumper crop, you would be a criminal just because you had more in possession than what you were allowed to grow. They want the ability to recover the costs associated with their work. The need for preemption has been very important because worried about local entities applying more taxes and making the system not sustainable. They support the residency requirements because we've been here a long time and want to do it the right way as Oregonians. If there are limitations on plant counts, they wanted reasonable ones. And if there's going to be tracking and reporting, they wanted it to be not so onerous that you would push more people out so that you bring people in and in a way that reflects the differences between a rural versus urban life. All those things I think we've made tremendous progress on, and I know that we have felt heard by each one of you on this committee, and so for all those points we want to keep working with you on, and we feel very appreciative of where we are. There's some things we need to get going on down the road after we get this bill out, some additional concerns, looking for a healthy medical market to sell into make sure that that's a process that works, whether it be through a co-op or our ability to sell into the rec market, just continuing conversation about how do we make sure the people that want to do it the right way have a market to sell into so they're not denied by a dispensary when they go with their medicine. Zoning protections are obviously going to be a big part of the land use system as we work forward. They are mostly operating on rural residential lands outside of city limits, but on rural residential lands. So we come into situations there with medical grows that we want to protect. There's always privacy and government interference concerns. We're working with, you know, we have to work out banking, hemp, the energy, environment, and water piece, all these things that we're talking about that we still are going to push charge forward with you on, and look forward to those conversations as we move ahead. And then very quickly on the bill before us today, 844 with dash sixes and dash sevens. On the plant limits, I think I'll let Anthony Johnson speak to that. I think he's coming later, and we support his kind of ideas for phasing in, but also just appreciate how much we've worked with you to get the limits to where they are now. And I think Anthony can talk a little bit more about his idea about maybe phasing them in over time that may work a little better. The ratchet back provisions that are in the bill are of concern to us. Just I think from the premise that the idea of we're trying to move people out of the medical and into recreation as medical growers. One of the first meetings we had, went around the room, we're trying to just collect opinions from the folks at the table, and said, you know, if all things were being equal moving forward, would you want to grow for recreational, or would you want to grow medical? Like absent everything else, just in terms of like, how do you want to do this? What would you like to do if they were both great systems to participate in? Which would you prefer? Every single person around the table said they wanted to keep growing medicine because they feel good about it for their patients, and they've crafted that, and that's what they want to do. So for them, it's kind of like, you know, why are we trying to push people out of the medical market instead of saying we could be regional, statewide, national leaders in producing incredible medicine for people who need it. As this technology gets better and better, we're doing incredible things. So the idea that we would kind of ratchet people off of the medical program is just something that kind of goes against their values as medical growers. The privacy for home gardens. The inspection allowances in the bill, we would hope that they would reflect the differences between a private kind of resident grow. These are home gardens, which is a different idea than operating as a business or operating as a dispensary or even operating as like a processor. So maybe the allowances for government inspection of homes could be less spelled out or just some, recognizing that there's a difference there between a home and those who are doing it for as a business. Protecting individual rights and freedoms. So this is a kind of a specific section. Section 39, which is on page 57 of the dash sixes, it's line 27. It has to do with the ability for someone to just file a complaint, and that would be sufficient enough for the OHA to release information to authorities. We feel like the authorities should be authorized to release that information, but only if they determine that a violation has been found, as compared to just someone issuing a complaint. That could be open the door for, who knows what kind of abuse. Testing expenses. The expense of testing is always something that concerns. We support testing. We want the medicine to be proven safe, but we want it to not be so expensive as to discourage its participation and growth. With Section 46 may be read to be a redundant testing requirement, so that ideally only the final product offered for consumption should be subject to the testing. Reporting, ideally moving to a quarterly reporting system instead of a monthly report requirement would be preferred. And then just on a specific, the bill mentions reporting weights of drying flower and leaf. And that was hard as the flower and leaf is drying, because it's the weight's going to change as it gets more dry. So that's just kind of not necessarily a good indicator of yield. So perhaps we might be able to address some of the reporting issues there. And then finally, again, on the residency requirements, we did a survey of the members and asked, you know, if that's something that they would support. It was near unanimously supported. Most of the folks there have been in Oregon for many, many years. They want to continue to kind of protect the craft that they have developed, and an influx of lots of people that aren't as necessarily skilled with how things are done there and in that particular place could damage the product and could damage their brand. I think of it as kind of when I first was getting to know this, I grew up in Georgia, we have Vidalia onions. It's kind of like a Walla Walla onion. And they fight and scrap, you know, for what it means to constitute a Vidalia onion, because that's a big thing. And yet I don't want folks from outside coming in and, you know, growing in soil that may be kind of close to the Vidalia soil, but not exactly there, and kind of calling it a Vidalia onion. So they know they've got something special, And I think for purposes of protecting the medicine as well as the economic interest, they would support the residency requirements. And with that, I'll just say thank you again for the time and for all of your great work, and look forward to continuing to working with you
weeks
ahead.
Well, and thank you for your testimony, and thank you for getting some of these ideas to us in advance. You will see some of them in the Dash 7s, and really appreciate your participation. We'll hold questions till the panel's done, but I wanted to make that comment to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So who's next?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Amy Margolis, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Cannabis PAC. I tried to think of what I was going to say, and I submitted written testimony, but I wanted to start with good bill should pass. And I thought about saying that for the next 5 minutes over and over again, in hopes that you will all move this bill relatively soon with both the Dash 6s and the Dash 7s. While I think every cannabis industry group in this state has grappled with how to address the medical marijuana program, from not touching it all the way through dismantling it, we believe that this is a very strong improvement, that there are a lot of positive things for this industry, particularly in the Dash 6s and the Dash 7s, which I think are an additional exceptional improvement. And I want to go through the things that actually help growers and help patients in this bill, and I think applaud the committee in getting to this place. First, this bill redefines what an immature plant is, as any plant that is not in flower. I think every cultivator in the state of Oregon would recognize that this change is long, long overdue. It improves the quality of cultivation. It improves the ability to enter into breeding programs. It is a big change, and we appreciate it, and we think it's a very common sense fix to a problem that's been around for a long time. Two, removing limits on immature plants. I know that Ms. Nato is going to testify as well, and we have worked with Mowgli, her client, for a long time on what a breeding program looks like. I know this committee is looking at a nursery license to address that issue. Allowing for there to be no limit on the number of immature plants is, again, something I think every cultivator in this state would applaud. And if my Facebook is any indication, every single one of them, even the ones who hate this bill, does like that piece. Possession limits are removed. I know Mr. Manton testified on behalf of the Sun Grown Guild, and we share, while we disagree with some things, we do share that you should be able to possess what you cultivate. Again, this is a common sense fix. It should have happened a long time ago, and we've said repeatedly that plant count and weight limit are tools for law enforcement to come in and assure compliance. We believe that we are far past that, and that possession limits should be directly related to what you harvest from your yield. The reimbursement language being removed. Again, we echo Mr. Manton's thoughts about this. We believe this has no negative impact on the grower-patient relationship, and it allows companies like the CO2 company, Ecofirma Farms, Lunchbox, Shango, and many more people to run a real business servicing patients through dispensaries, collaborating with other growers, and interacting with the dynamic and creative people in the cannabis industry. More importantly, it lifts this huge threat of prosecution. And as a criminal defense attorney, what we would often see is people trying to justify through their record keeping that something was true reimbursement, that my utilities equaled this, and my labor if I'm going to dispensary equaled this, and you're juggling and you're really engaging in a very, very difficult process. And we believe that lifting this requirement allows for us to transition into a true market, whether it's on the medical side or the commercial side, and it takes law enforcement even more out of this picture. Creating a processor license. This is a huge thing for the legislature to do, and we applaud this committee for doing it. When the medical marijuana program was created in 1998 and approved in 2005, no one could have envisioned that this is what this would look like now. And a number of extremely creative and ambitious people have catapulted this industry, and one of the ways they've done it is through processing, extraction, concentrates, edibles. And so creating a processor license is, from our perspective, the next step forward. And again, we focus on what keeps our clients safe and creating. Right now, processors juggle caregiver cards in order to be able to process, and this puts everybody in danger of prosecution. Creating a processor's license would alleviate some of that fear, and as you heard from all of the testimony, and we applaud this committee for hearing so much public testimony about the medical program so far, what you heard very often was that people were using concentrates and extracts to treat medical conditions, and creating a processor license creates that interface between the patient and the grower and the concentrator extractor. So again, we support the creation of the processor's license. The preemption language. I know that this is a touchy subject, and the PAC understands that this is a touchy subject. I am going to speak from my perspective as a business attorney managing a patchwork of local legislation and land use, all the way from what we've seen in Wilsonville, where they said, no, we are going to go against the will of the legislature. We are not going to allow dispensaries. Come sue us if you want, through other local governments who are making unrealistic and burdensome decisions. The fact that this committee is even willing to engage in the conversation of how to prevent that kind of patchwork of local legislation is a worthwhile conversation. We hope that that part stays in here. We're willing to engage in further conversations and think that that piece should be part of a broader discussion, as we're likely to see it again when we start talking about ballot measure 91. The tracking system. The PAC supports a system of tracking. We want that system to be sensible and not overly burdensome. We've talked about it in our meetings a number of times, and we do not view the tracking system as a way to trap people or to catch them doing something wrong, and we hope that the committee doesn't view it that way, and when OHA makes the tracking rules, that they don't view it that way. We view it as a way for the state of Oregon to understand holistically how much cannabis is cultivated and moved through the state of Oregon, so in a moving forward basis, you can make good decisions and smart regulations. And I think it directly interfaces with how you will regulate canopy size in terms of recreational, not just this session, but on a moving forward basis. We share some of the concerns about inspections. We think that they're important. We recognize they're going to happen. We are concerned about home inspections. We had a PAC meeting today, and that was a huge concern. I can share, again, as from my attorney perspective, as somebody who's represented people who were losing their kids, that entering homes is also not always safe for agencies, and that in an effort to protect both agencies and people's privacy, that we would hope that when OHA goes, and we believe OHA should make these tracking rules with input from the industry, that when OHA makes these rules, that they take into consideration that small gardens at people's homes for personal use should not be subject to inspection. We recognize that bigger inspections are going to happen, and our members are okay with that and understand and are prepared for that, but we share some of those concerns. Finally, we are asking you as a PAC to move this bill, and I am asking you as an attorney who is now told more clients than I can count that I don't know what is going to happen to ballot measure 91, that we are hoping that this bill moves and then this committee will move on to ballot measure 91. As we approach May, the PAC feels it's time to move on to a number of other serious issues. It is extremely complicated work coming up next. Not that this was not extremely complicated, but what is coming next is just as complicated. There are many issues: residency, taxes, additional local government issues, potential for pre-sales in July, all of the myriad of licensing issues, and on and on. These are not simple issues for this committee to manage, and it is time for the committee to attack them. The PAC has expressed concern to me, and I will express concern to the committee, that if more time is spent focused on this issue, that the rest of the issues may not receive as much attention as they deserve. Finally, in conclusion, I want to say that I recognize we will all be back here again in 2016 and 2017, and God forbid, 2018, 19, 20, and so on. As a committee, the PAC recognizes that you have treated this issue with immense respect and care. This is a good bill. We hope you move it. Will you need to fix things later? Probably. Should this happen now? The PAC does not think so. There are many opportunities to fine-tune this in the rulemaking process, as well as once this bill leaves committee. Again, we want to express our sincere appreciation for the time and energy you spent on this issue, and we are excited to see you give ballot measure 91 the same time and energy. Thank you for this opportunity.
And thank you, Lisa.
Good evening, co-chairs Burdick and Leininger, and members of the committee for implementing Measure 91. For the record, I am Lisa Nato, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 844. Our firm represents Phylos Bioscience, an Oregon biotech company. Dr. Mowgli Holmes is the chief scientific officer and has presented testimony to this committee on numerous occasions. He is also the co-founder of the Cannabis Safety Institute, which was formed to provide research and scientific information related to cannabis. Our goal is for Oregon to become the national model in industry-leading consumer health and safety standards for laboratory certification and cannabis testing based on science. The Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 844 position Oregon to achieve this goal. First, the amendments require that laboratories licensed for cannabis testing must be accredited and held to the same scientific and professional standards of other analytical laboratories. Oregon is fortunate to host the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program, ORLAP, administered through the Oregon Health Authority, which is respected in the scientific community and internationally. For the first time in Oregon, laboratories testing marijuana will be accredited by ORLAP, which will help ensure that consumers receive accurate information about potency and assure the public that cannabis products have been tested accurately for known health risks. Secondly, the amendments require minimum standards in statute for testing marijuana products. Marijuana will be required to be tested for microbiological contaminants, pesticides, and other contaminants, which could include heavy metals. Procedures are required to test concentrates and extracts to protect public health. Additionally, procedures will be required for tracking marijuana and marijuana products during the testing process and also for documenting and reporting test results. The amendments strike the appropriate balance between legislation and rule making by allowing for additional standards for testing marijuana by rule. The Oregon Health Authority, in consultation with Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the State Department of Agriculture, will adopt rules that specify the specific procedures and the specific substances to test for. This is appropriate, as procedures will change as new technologies are developed or new contaminants are identified. Flexibility through the rulemaking process is achieved through these amendments. The proposed amendments do not apply to personal grows or primary caregivers under the medical marijuana system, and the proposed amendments are sensitive to the costs involved for these testing procedures for marijuana in the commercial market. The rulemaking process must consider the cost of a potential procedure and may not adopt more rules than are necessary to protect the public health and safety. With an appropriate balance of safety and cost, consumers will want a safe product rather than seek out marijuana from the black market. Thank you for all the work you have done on the issues of laboratory certification and testing for public health and safety. You have considered detailed and lengthy technical and scientific information in your deliberations. Thank you for basing your decisions and these amendments on that science. I want to particularly thank Co-Chair Leininger for her leadership in taking on these public health issues and Senator Cruz for participating in the informal work group and sharing his expertise. Finally, appreciation must be given to Mark Mayer for taking these complex concepts and drafting them into a workable statutory framework. Last February, I attended one of the listening sessions held by the OLCC. It was here in Salem. There must have been several hundred people there. And I know if you added up all the listening sessions, there must have been thousands. There was virtually unanimous support for health and safety testing for marijuana products and appropriate labeling. The importance of your work to protect the health and safety of marijuana consumers can't be overstated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I learned a lot about this amendment from you all. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Early.
Well, I'll defer to my colleague from the House.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, thank you. Not that it hasn't been interesting already, but now it really gets interesting to me, because now we turn back to Measure 91. And for those who have a desire to live by the tenets of 91, this makes it extremely interesting as these two programs begin to marry up. And there will be some sections that obviously are going to need to enjoy some congruency here. And so look forward to what we have to do next, because these two programs do have to marry up significantly. And again, I think we need to be extremely careful about the will of the voters as expressed in 91. So I hope as we go forward, we remember that. This is quite a process here, and we appreciate all that we've learned about it, because most of us came into this as total rookies, and in many ways we still are. But yet, I hate to use the term monkey with a gun, but we're kind of like that in a way. And so we're trying to get it right. And so I look forward to more of this kind of work as we continue to pull these programs together, make them make sense together.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you.
The medical system has been characterized as a largely unregulated system. And the Cole Memorandum is quite clear about wanting to see us do what we can to reduce the leakage. And so I'll just ask the committee member, the panel members, do you see a clear and convincing argument within the framework of 844 with the dash 6 and 7 that support the argument that we will see a significant reduction of leakage from the medical system into the a non-regulated, unregulated, or illicit market?
Thank you, Senator Farrelly, and members of the committee, co-chair, since looking at me, I'll take a first stab at it. I would say that, in my opinion, and I think that of the growers that I know, the responsible growers that I work with, that the best way to eliminate and reduce as much as possible that unregulated market would be to bring people in, and so that you have a system that is appealing from the perspective of all those who would participate in it, and so that you're not kind of scaring folks away. I think your idea, Senator, of that first year of allowing the medical dispensaries to sell into the recreational market is a wonderful way of getting at that, because you have a viable market for folks to come sell and participate in. I think that if the regulatory regime is such that it's not frightening for those who don't have a whole lot of trust in government, it's going to help. I think if the the tracking and the reporting is user friendly, so that people can go online and knock it out and do it, and it's not, you know, you don't have to worry about the boogeyman government agent coming to your house. If there is a viable market for them to sell into, that's not four or five hours away up in Portland. All these factors that make the regulatory market, the legal market, more appealing is how we get at the unregulated market, I think. And I think that we've seen a long history of prohibition that has, as we saw testimony, that it's so easy for people to get access to the products under prohibition. That hasn't worked. And so hopefully this entire taxing, regulating, and state involvement in both more the medical that we're talking about today and then the recreational will help.
Senator Farrelly, Madam Chairs, I look at it from a different perspective, as having defended these cases for 13 years and worked in the federal criminal justice system myself, and still do that some. the way I think that the PAC sees it is that you really do need to be able to look the federal government in the eye and say, we have created some walls around the medical system. And, I mean, you have a big job. You have to please the people who are participating, like Mr. Manton is suggesting, and you have to please, I mean, those aren't the only people you have to please, right? So, I mean, you also have to please the federal government, who will be watching and looking at what you are doing. And I believe that you can look the federal government in the eye with 844-6 and 7 and say, we have addressed plant count. We have addressed tracking. We have addressed enforcement. We have addressed all of those pieces that the federal government looks for. And we talk about in our office what we know and what you can argue about, meaning if somebody comes and arrests you, what can I argue about to maybe get you out of jail? And we think about it in those terms. And in this case, how we perceive it is that you are creating enough containment around this system and enough accountability, not too much, and not too much that it scares people away, but enough that you could look the federal government in the eye and say, we have made an affirmative step forward. We have a carrot, which is the accessibility of the system, and we have a stick, which is some civil enforcement and some tracking and some access to law enforcement. And law enforcement loves the carrot and the stick analogy. So I think that this is a perfect, perfect bill for that, and you could certainly exist within the parameters of the Cole memo.
Thank you. All right, thank you. We'll move to our next panel.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I did have a follow-up.
You did? Yes. Well, hurry up, we're running out of time.
It's pretty quick. It's for the co-chairs. Mm-hmm. It's for the co-chairs.
Yes, go on.
Are we going to vet this with the folks that wrote the Cole Amendment and ask for feedback? Are we just going to fire for effect and see where she lands?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Nope, I'm serious. There's folks out there watching with great interest, and I think we heard really well-articulated arguments. But I'm wondering if at some point in time we actually ask for the opinion, does this... I mean, I hate to put us in a situation of bring us a rock, because the federal government's famous for saying, well, bring us a rock. And now we don't like that rock, go bring us another rock. But it wouldn't hurt just to have some sense that we have, in fact, built a defensible, affirmatively defensible system that met the four corners of the Cole Memorandum.
Well, if you've read
if you don't want to know about it now, the next thing you hear is a knock on the door later. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you have read the Cole Amendment, which I know you have, you'll know that the federal government is very cagey about not making a commitment. They give guidelines. They do not make a commitment. And I don't expect one to be forthcoming.
That would be a no.
All we can do is our best.
Madam Chair. And I think in addition to what you just articulated, we've been working closely with our counsel, Mark Mayer, and with his help tried to develop systems that are elements of this legislation that will help satisfy those requirements in their face. So we're definitely attuned to it and trying to tailor the legislation to meet those requirements.
And Madam Chair, it's we may refer to Mr. Mayer from this point forward as the unindicted co-conspirator.
With that, we will move on to our next panel, the two Anthonys, Anthony Johnson and Anthony Taylor.
Who's got the hand out of the way?
It's you. Yours got some great notes.
Wow.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Anthony Johnson, Chief Petitioner, Measure 91, for the record. I think spoken with many of you throughout the session and starting this session, my preference was to not impact the medical marijuana program and let Measure 91 be implemented first and seeing how the program Measure 91 would impact the medical marijuana program and see what is needed. That said, I am very happy that the committee has taken up issues that have been addressed already that have plagued the medical marijuana program for some time. The definition of immature plants, local preemption, the reimbursement language, treating marijuana like other medicines. Those are all steps positive forward, and I thank you very much for those. That said, my main concern now, and I think for many advocates that have been in the working as a medical marijuana reform advocate, are the patients and the patients that depend upon growers, and the concern that the reduction in grow sites, that patient gardens, is going to have on the sickest and poorest patients among us, and that grandfathering in gardens is a great start. However, you know, one thing that, you know, struck me is if a grower who is growing for patients, if they pass away, for instance, and then those patients need new growers, restricting the plant limits prevents a lot of other good growers from taking in those patients. So while my preference would be no limit on patient gardens, so we can always ensure that patients can find a good grower, my compromise solution is to wait to phase in the limits on grow sites. I would prefer, you know, July 1st, 2017, however far back we can go, July 1st, 2017 would allow the Measure 91 system to be implemented. I don't think we'll see stores licensed by the OLCC for the Measure 91 program until October of 2016. We'd have time in another legislative session to adapt and to ensure that patients don't lose their grower and lose their supply of medicine, because too many patients don't have the ability to stop into a dispensary. So that'd be my number one concern, and ask that you change either the plant limits or just push that back some time to give the program time to adjust and give us time all to see how the system operates and to protect the most vulnerable patients among us. Next, and it's been touched on by the previous panel, the inspections and the ability to call law enforcement. I think that's most burdensome upon residential areas. I think that that has the capability of pushing out some good growers who have been charitably growing for patients. I know you've been contacted, you know, for instance, by one grower in Portland who only grows for patients in hospice care. And someone like him, who doesn't make a profit on this, to undergo home inspections and just the threat that the police could be called on him, could push good people like him out of the system. So again, I would urge to not have home inspections of residential gardens, or at least, again, put that off till July 1st, 2017. And as we move forward, I think that we should just always remember that the medical program is here for the patients first and foremost. And I hope to continue to work with everyone on the committee to ensure that patients are protected. I would love to see low-income patient program that is funded from the money that's generated from, say, the Measure 91 taxation system to provide medicine to patients that desperately need it, who may indeed lose their grower over time. So I think let's just take our time, take into account the patients, and maybe put off some of the inspections, being able to call law enforcement, and the limits on gardens that will only hurt some of the most vulnerable patients. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Other Anthony.
Yeah, I hope you don't get us confused. My name is Anthony Taylor, and I am the director of Compassionate Oregon, a patient advocacy group. I would like to also echo the sentiments of previous witnesses here in thanking the committee for the hard work they've done. I know trying to get your head wrapped around the medical marijuana program is a huge endeavor, and you've been fairly successful at it. I apologize. I've been pretty busy this week. For not having written testimony, but I'll get that submitted within the next 24 hours. Compassionate Oregon generally supports some of these changes in this amendment, in the 844 amendments, but we do think there's room for some improvement without too much controversy. We're worried about patients, of course, and losing growers, and we're also concerned about incentivizing growers to be able to stay with the medical marijuana program so that the effect or the impact on patients is minimized. And in the dash six, we talk about limiting the growth to 4 cards per address. This could be problematic in the sense that we're putting a cap on the number of plants we can grow. So why should we restrict it to the number to 4 patients? If we are growing, there's many patient growers in this state that provide, they're allowed to grow for 40 patients, for instance. So that's 240 plants, but they might only have 90 plants in the ground. And it's taking care of the ongoing needs of all those patients. And I think limiting it to 4 patients per address will kind of knock that ability for the patients to provide, or the growers to provide for more patients, back a little bit. I think if you're going to cap it at 48 or 12 or whatever it might be, if you feel that you can adequately provide for the ongoing needs of 20 patients with 48 plants, I think we should make allowances for that. And that will help, you know, patients that lose their growers along the way. Along with that, I think we need to implement, because there's a part in the, there's a section in the dash sixes that allows for assigning some ownership to the growers from the patient. I think we should take that a little further and allow for a patient grower grievance hotline, if we can, with the programs to address some of these problems, because we always hear the stories about patients that aren't getting an adequate product or growers that are being harassed by patients, and I think this would enable us to address some of those concerns. I would echo the sentiment that monthly reporting may seem excessive, and I think that in the overall scheme of things, we've now in the dash sevens allowed for the patients, I lost my train of thought here, sorry. So we've allowed for no home inspections for the home grow, the one patient or the patient providing for a family member. I think we need to extend that into designated grow sites as well for the patient, the grower that's just growing for his brother or for his father or his sister and maybe another family member. So a 2 patient scenario that exempts those people or provides an exception for inspections. And I think hand in hand with that, we also need to look at it at a bigger picture, because as Mr. Johnson alluded to, this one grower in Portland that provides for a lot of residential care facility patients, those patients need some kind of relief from excessive reporting. If they've opted out of the dispensary, if they've opted out of being involved with the retail market, they need some kind of consideration, and I think the committee should look to find a way to do that. Background checks. It seems to some of us odd that a disqualifying factor is your conviction of a controlled substance violation. It seems odd that if you were convicted of something that now may be legal, that you're prohibited from having a site or a dispensary or a garden. And to that as well, we need to, I think, look at some of the other violations that might happen or convictions. Do we want people with identity theft or, you know, those sorts of violations and convictions on their record to be part of a dispensary where they handle money or other things of value? Just briefly on testing, I think the committee did an excellent job on testing, and I think it's provided a great foundation for the OLCC to look at and be able to ensure public safety for everybody, and with the same kind of testing being applied. I haven't dug in too much to the packaging labeling, but from what I've seen, I think that the committee, again, has done a great job on that. One last thing. There, we've kind of reworked the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, but we've left some things out that I think that are important. Some of those are like broadening the responsibilities for the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana. This committee has routinely been sidelined from participating in the legislative process, and I think that not only should they be able to advise the director on the program and the fees, but they also should be able to advise the legislature, and I think we need to make provisions for that. So I guess in conclusion, I really do appreciate the work that the committee has done so far this session, and I hope that they'll consider a few more adjustments to the this bill and then move it. And thank you very much for allowing us to testify to this evening.
Thank you, Anthony. And I want to, on behalf of the entire committee, express condolences to you for the loss of your mother this week. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Buckley.
Madam Co-Chair, yes. Mr. Taylor, the idea of a grievance hotline is intriguing to me, and I think given the experience my staff has gained in recent days, I think my office could volunteer.
Yeah, I think they have got plenty of experience for sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other comments? Senator Pruzanski.
Yeah, this is Anthony Johnson. Anthony, when you were talking about plant numbers and gardens and either going with no limits or phasing in, you gave the example if a grower died that the patients would not have that. It also seems that from what we've heard, there is an anticipation that some growers are going to want to leave the medical model and go into the rec model. So with the phase-in that you have, do you see that as an opportunity to ensure that patients would still have access to medicine during that period of time so you don't have patients not having growers because the growers have made a decision to ramp up for recreation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Pruzanski. Yeah, I think phasing in will allow good growers who care about patients to take in those patients who may have been left by growers who moved on to the Measure 91 system or moved on to the other side, if you will. And also it'll give us time to hear from and learn from patients and get their stories. And I think that we'll have evidence of how Measure 91 plays out, and these limits, rules, regulations, oversights will still be in place and there if it's definitely proven that it's needed. But we can ensure that patients won't be hindered in their ability to have a grow site if we just wait to put in to phase in the limits on the plant numbers.
Representative Lang.
Thank you so much. Thank you to both of you, but to everyone who's been part of this process, the prior panel, Mr. Taylor, your dedication to this work at a time like this is really, you know, manifests a lot of the values that people bring to the medical marijuana program, and I'm grateful for that. I was really interested in your comment about background checks, and that a ding on your background check for conduct related to marijuana that would be legal now going forward with the enactment of Measure 91 seems, you know, nonsense. And I think that that's a great point. And I would like to see us not have prior conduct related to marijuana that would be legal now under Measure 91 be a basis for not being eligible to be either a participant in the OMMA part or the Measure 91 part. I think as we talked about last meeting, there are some fixes that may be universal fixes that we'll need to consider that we won't be considering in time for Monday. But that we could still be considering as we move forward in other arenas. And so I wanted to placemark that as something that I think is important, and also the expungement of marijuana-related offenses, because I know that, you know, a huge operative goal of people who are supporting legalization is to get at that criminalization issue and how it hurts people, even if it happened in the past. So thank you for that and for all your work.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And I wanted to echo that, too. This is a good example. This has been a massive project, faceted project to get to the point where we are. And the criminal background check has not been an area of focus. We will be paying more attention to it in the Measure 91 bill, and anything we do there, I anticipate, would lap over into this. So I'd like to continue that conversation because the issues are very real. Basically, the people who know how to grow marijuana are more likely to have certain criminal convictions. And so we need to be very careful how we manage that.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would also add that, you know, in the work that we did with the Rules Advisory Committee with the Office of the Child Care, for the central background registry for that particular office is huge, and they break it all down into, you know, what's good for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years, and no years. And it's a long list, and it has some good definitions that we could incorporate in future. Right.
We will continue minutes. The conversation going in.
Great. Thank you.
We're not done with you all yet. All right. Thank you very much. Our next panel will be Rob Bovet and Teresa Marchetti. And Andy Smith. Welcome.
Beauty before home.
Chair Zeininger and Chair Burdick, I'm Teresa Marchetti. I'm the City of Portland Livability Programs Manager for the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide feedback on the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 844. We do believe that this is a very strong start to regulating what is really an unregulated industry. Our council supports medical marijuana and wants to ensure that patients have access to their medicine. However, this industry, like many industries, in the absence of reasonable regulations, can cause unnecessary and often unintentional public safety and livability issues. There is a wide spectrum of behavior in any industry, and to the extent that we can provide a roadmap for success for these businesses and address issues proactively, as I think some components of this bill really do, rather than having to address those on the back end after impacts are already felt by our local communities, we are very supportive of that. A couple of the highlights that we wanted to mention, establishing registrations for grow sites, helping to monitor those not in compliance, restricting processing and retail from residential zones, especially because of the volatility of the extraction process in particular. We really feel like that component preserves neighborhoods. Limiting plant counts on grow sites in urban residential areas, we think that's very important, especially due to the density of our urban residential zones and the potential nuisance issues there. Creating accountability for card holders and designees who are not in compliance with local law, that is also tied to their ability to operate. And also the requirement the dispensary have security protocols and systems in place is a huge step for public safety and also, I think, the security of the members of the industry involved as well. Creating this regulatory system for medical marijuana is really an important step in implementing Measure 91, and we appreciate the attention that it's been given. Even though we are definitely not the first, we're still a test nationally for establishing a legitimate marijuana industry, and to the extent that we can hold up to outside scrutiny, we've heard from other jurisdictions that really involves getting our medical marijuana house in order. I know that this is an extremely complex issue. I just want to thank you again for allowing us to provide some feedback from the local government standpoint, and we really look forward to working with you on the implementation of Measure 91 as well.
Thanks. Mr. Bobet.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties.
Andy indicates he's just here for questions. So, first off, a general comment that I would echo, you've heard from a lot of other folks. There's a lot of good stuff in all of these amendments, dash 6 through dash 12. That being said, I want to touch base on just a couple of issues. First is from a law enforcement perspective, and I think I've mentioned this to a number of you individually, but maybe not collectively. We have assembled, when all of this started to come down many months ago, an internal committee of experts from all the law enforcement associations, essentially our little brain trust, and we run everything through them. I forget exactly what the acronym means, but it's OLEMLARC. That's what it is. And so I run everything through them and get feedback. And one of the things they noticed immediately was Section 15. So let me talk about Section 15 of the DAC 6 amendments. And by the way, I have provided you a one-page document that kind of summarizes what I'm going to lay out here for you this evening. So as we all envision it, we're going to be creating two regulatory boxes. One of those boxes I'm going to call Regulation Light for medical marijuana. And the other one is probably more like full regulation for retail marijuana. We heard fairly loud and clear from a number of key stakeholders, including the OLCC, that they really need and want the assistance of law enforcement to make sure that people are playing inside the boxes, and those that are not playing inside the boxes and creating unfair competition to those who are enforced out of the system. In other words, it's a fancy long way of saying drive out the black market. Because OLCC doesn't have the resources, and neither does OHA. And for the longest time, in spite of what others might say or believe, marijuana enforcement has been a very low priority in the state of Oregon for law enforcement, really since 1973. And so we're asking law enforcement to re-engage and become an active participant in helping to drive out the black market and to ensure and protect those that are actually operating within one of the two regulatory boxes. So one of the key things that they've been looking for from this committee is an indication that you want them to participate. In order for them to participate, they need information. And when we got to Section 15, it largely is status quo. It blocks them from information. What they need is information about who is inside. From a licensed business perspective, who is inside one of those two regulatory boxes and who is not? Law enforcement needs bright, clean lines and easy access to data. Section 15 denies them that. So we would strongly urge you and encourage you to send a different message to law enforcement and to provide them something they haven't had before, which is easy access, ready access to information to quickly identify who's operating inside the box and who's not, so they can do what I think you're going to ask them to do. Otherwise, they simply can't perform the task. So that's a key component, and I think in the absence of that, you won't have your local law enforcement partners to assist in that endeavor. And so Section 15 needs to change the paradigm, because the paradigm is changing. On a second issue, I'm going to sound a bit like a broken record, but I'll try not to, and that is the issue of preemption. So in each of the other states that currently has licensed medical marijuana businesses, and both of the other two states that currently have licensed retail marijuana businesses, there is no preemption of local control or opt-out. In fact, it's enshrined in the Colorado Constitution, and the Washington Attorney General has vigorously and thus far successfully defended local control and opt-out. And you might say, why is that? And my answer for you is the same reason I've expressed twice before this committee, and I provided links in my written testimony to that explanation. It's avoiding the federal question, because from our perspective at AOC, and LOC shares this perspective, it's best we avoid that federal question because it poses grave risks to both licensing schemes. We would rather not confront those risks, because the truth is that AOC and LOC are agnostic on marijuana. We have members that fully support it, want full rollout of retail and the medical. We have others that want to have lots of growing and be producers, others that don't want retail within their jurisdictions, a variety of situations. And so the common thread is local control and opt-out. So the Dash 6 would chart a completely different course than any other state has embarked upon, which is preemption. Preemption of local opt-out and really confining the range of local regulation. We think that's the wrong direction and will drive the federal question. So I would strongly urge you to reconsider that, not as really a matter of policy, but just as much a matter of law. And so for those purposes, I haven't really dug into them very deeply, but I see the Dash 10s that I think provide a better solution to the opt-out issue. And then I also saw the Dash 11s, which provide a better answer to the database issue that I talked about, because I think we truly do need our law enforcement partners to participate and help us and help those that are licensed be protected from those who are operating without licensure. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee? When you talk about access to the data, I think one of the concerns is the issue of not all law enforcement agencies are supportive of the program, and the issue is where do you draw the line between effective law enforcement and harassment or just mining for information inappropriately?
Co-Chair Burdick, I do hear that concern, but the reality is that the paradigm has changed. We have, in Measure 91, changed the paradigm as well as this bill in whatever form it comes out. I think that most law enforcement doesn't operate that way, but we're actually asking them to do something new. We're asking them to be the enforcers against those who are operating outside the regulatory box. I fully understand the tortured history here. I get it. And in the past, OHA has been very protective of everything within the OMMA from law enforcement. I get that too. But we really fundamentally need a legal and an attitude change on all sides if law enforcement is going to do what I think you want and need them to do. And without access to the data about who's in the system and who's not, they can't do what you need them to do. If there's a car stop on I-5 and Mr. Crawford has 30 pounds of marijuana.
Again.
Last time it was 40. We want to be able to run him right there and say, boom, he's in the medical marijuana box, on your way. Or boom, he's in the Measure 91 box, on your way. Or you're not in the system, Mr. Crawford. We've got to take you out of the system because you're competing against people who shouldn't be in the system. So that's the fundamental core of it. I understand there is a lot of trust that's required here, I think, on all sides. But I do see a potential big fail if we don't empower law enforcement to do what they need to do and what I think we all need them to do in this completely new paradigm.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob, addressing Senate Bill 844, Dash 6, do you have more comfort if it is amended with something that looks like Section 60 out of Measure 91, the local option there?
Co-chairs and Representative Wilson, no. And the reason I say that is we'll wind up with a jurisdiction or multiple jurisdictions that look a lot like the city of Cave Junction. And then we'll be dealing with the federal question. If this bill were to pass today, it could alter the course of the litigation that's currently in the Court of Appeals and possibly prevent my ability to prevent the federal question from being answered in Oregon, because you may have mooted my efforts to do that. And so I think that providing anything other than what all the other states have is fraught with danger, because someone's going to be doing something outside of that narrow box, and we'll be back here again.
Other Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Rob, a couple of things. On the database, we have seen in previous years where there's been documentation where it appears that access to that information has been misused or misappropriated. Do you believe that if we actually did something in the sense of what you would like to see this committee do, that sanctions should be also implied for those officers who are working outside of the box?
Co-Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, one is, and maybe I'm super optimistic, because we've changed the paradigm, I don't think we'll see those abuses. But to directly answer your question, absolutely. If people are going to misuse and abuse the database for whatever purposes, those people need to be sanctioned.
Then on the preemption regarding the federal issue, understand your belief that if this committee went that route, that you would be able to, or I guess what guarantee do you have that your counties or the League of Cities doesn't have a city who chooses to still push that federal question?
And Co-Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, two reasons. One is a very practical one, and we've seen it play out in Colorado, for example, where they have clean opt-out. And I say clean opt-out, it's not of all license categories. So, for example, there are counties in Colorado that, like, for example, I can envision Jackson County doing this, want to be a major producer, but don't want the retail shops located in unincorporated areas, want them in the cities. What you do by providing clean opt-out is there's no reason why they have to go to court, because you've empowered them to do what they want to do. You've created local choice and local options. So essentially, functionally, you've denied them standing, because they can't complain, because they can do what they want to do. There's no remedy that they need. And we've seen that play out as a practical matter in all of these other states, both with regard to licensed medical marijuana businesses and in the two states that have licensed retail businesses.
But there is follow-up. You could, as you said in your presentation, even within a community, you could have those who favor versus those who don't. Those in power could be split as well, and they could still push the question if their side didn't win.
Co-Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, I believe that is theoretically possible, and we've seen some litigation along those lines in the state of Colorado. I believe, however, and it's just my opinion, that all of those suits will fail for lack of standing.
Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I couldn't articulate the argument any better, but I can provide a couple of real specific examples, perhaps. The city police chiefs have called my office and asked about their ability to enforce current law or just get a handle on what's happening in their communities. There's boarded up warehouses and storefronts and apparent activity there. And the question is, you know, we pay our law enforcement officers to be vigilant and curious. We spent part of the week honoring fallen law enforcement officers with Oregon's highest, or at least the Senate's highest, honor. And they're asking me, will I be able to know what goes on behind those blacked out windows and barred doors? Because it has public safety implications, and that's my job, is to keep people safe, you know, and if they're engaged in a legitimate activity, they deserve the full protection of the law. And if they're not, then the other citizens in my community deserve the full protection of the law. And it's a paradox that we put people in. And it's an untenable paradox, because the person in the blue uniform isn't supposed to have to equivocate. They're supposed to act to protect and defend. And putting him into a position of equivocation is putting him in danger, really. The other issue we talked about when the senator and I made our debut appearance together as the dinner theater at the Oregonian Live Symposium on marijuana, getting it right. And I tried to make the point there that there's a large population of early adopters. There's a large population of people who are migrating forward toward the change that the Measure 91 indicated Oregonians want to take, but there's also a large population of people who voted quite handily against this, in some cases 68% against in Malheur County and 63% against in Wheeler County, which only has 1,700 people living in it. It's half the population of my high school in Portland. And to force folks into a situation where they couldn't say no is to just create an invitation to litigation and demonstrative behaviors where if they had a pure opt-out, then you even if you tried to file a suit, you'd be told by the courts you can solve that at a lower administrative level. You have no basis to litigate. You can't even bring your case here. So, you know, that isn't the vindication that I think the folks who are in support of Measure 91 wanted. It certainly isn't an expression of what people are saying when they crick their finger and say it's the will of the people. But it does allow people an opportunity to get to accommodate social change over time instead of going off a social cliff, which may not be possible for some to accommodate. That presents a set of problems. We don't have a delivery system for all the folks in the medical
field. That's for another subject.
It is, but my point is there are other solutions to guarantee that people who have medical needs get them serviced and met. And that's a compassionate requirement. And I think that's what's at the heart of what our efforts on 844. So, you know, I would just echo what Mr. Bovet has had to say. You can try for all of it, and you can end up in federal court, possibly. Or you can look at accommodating different local community values and still accommodate the needs for the medical users.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Senator Pruszynski.
Yeah, Rob, regarding the current process for officers to call into OHA, why do you think that's not working in the sense of my understanding is that if they believe that there's activity happening that may be illegal, that they can call and find out whether or not that is a designated grow site or a cardholder, and the same if they're driving down the highway, being able to identify Mr. Crawford as being within that system.
Co-Chair Burdick and Senator Ferrioli, I don't know that I can adequately characterize the frustration I've heard from law enforcement over the years with the current call-in system of getting information out of OHA. Suffice to say that they find it to be non-responsive in many cases, delayed and very limited. And what we really need to empower law enforcement to do is to deal with car stops in 5 minutes, to literally have them run through everything else they run through and have the answer instantly so they're not holding someone up for an hour or whatever when they get the call back with limited information and are playing a dancing game over the phone. It really does need to be automated, integrated, just part of the routine, so people who are operating lawfully inside the systems, either one or both, can get on their way.
It sounds to me like it's not a statutory problem. It sounds like it's an implementation problem. The information is there. It's taking too long to get it.
Chair Burdick, it would be a statutory problem under the current language of Section 15 of the Dash 6s.
Because
it requires, in order for anything out of the database to be shared, it requires that OHA develop information that there is, in fact, a violation and then share it with law enforcement. One, that's backwards, and two, there doesn't need to be and there shouldn't be a hitch.
So you're saying that current law would have allowed the officer to call in, but this does not?
Co-Chair Burdick, current law allows the officer to call in for specific narrow information, assuming that someone's available and can get it to them. The Dash 6s would preclude law enforcement from getting access to the new database, electronic database of information about the businesses, unless OHA developed their own reasons to believe there was a violation. So it's backward and shouldn't have the hitch. So the Dash 11s would turn that upside down and make it fly like it should fly.
Okay, as I understand the Dash 11, it would also provide a wide range of information, more information that's available than is available under current law.
Co-Chair Burdick, that's correct, but it would preserve and protect and limit or prohibit access to personally identifiable health information, information about patients and caregivers, which law enforcement doesn't need. And if they do need that for some investigatory reason because they're at some search warrant site, they can do the traditional phone call method for that stuff. We're not talking about that. We're really talking about the business information.
Chair Leininger.
Thank you. So while you prefer the Dash 11s and they address some, or you don't like how the bill is written right now in terms of database access. Does the bill currently prohibit the call-in method for access to information? And if not, if that were implemented more effectively than perhaps it is now, wouldn't that meet the need you're describing for roadside stops?
Co-Chair Leininger, I asked that very question this morning of the committee folk. And the response I got after they had read this, the response was fairly simple. Well, they want to keep it the way it is and not have us participate. And so that's how they read Section 15, and that's how I read it too, because it's not changing the current situation, which to them is not that functional. And you're talking about changing it and making it more functional, and I would urge you to consider the Dash 11s as exactly what is needed to make it more functional.
Yeah. So, but though I understand that the Dash 11s are your preferred next step, what I'm hearing you say is that the call-in method doesn't get terminated by 844-6 or -7, though there, it sounds like, are legitimate reasons to be frustrated with the call-in method. So if we were to strengthen responsiveness in the call-in method, that would be one step toward improvement, though you would also prefer adding the Dash 11s.
Co-Chair Leininger, that's a fair characterization. I think we could come up with some language that would get us closer there to where we are. Obviously, our preference would be to have clean access to the data that we need. I think the call-in method is just fine and practical for search warrant sites. It works well in that context, but it doesn't work well in normal law enforcement interactions. It's just, it's not practical and not workable as it is. But there might be some middle ground. I'm not sure what that devil would be in the details.
Ripson and Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Rob, just to, for my education, on the OLCC side, on the liquor side, does OLCC have a process when there's some sort of perceived or possible violation? Do they have a call-in process, or is that information already in a database that an officer can check on?
Co-Chair Burdick and Representative Buckley, that gets me into a bigger conversation, which I had, and I'll try to keep it really brief. I can envision that what I've proposed here and the Dash 11s proposed here, while important up front, I can envision within a few years it becoming irrelevant, because your purpose is to drive out the black market. While there is a black market in alcohol, it's insignificant. So I can envision the Dash 11s being important now and becoming largely moot and irrelevant within a few short years if we're successful in driving out the black market.
And this might be something to comment on. It seems that if there is, as Senator Brzezinski brought up, a certain amount of concern and lack of trust involved in, on the law enforcement side, a frustration, it could be that the Measure 91 regulations might be the opportunity to establish a database system for Measure 91 participants, a license holder who, or employee of a license holder who is transporting marijuana could be in a database. We're starting a new program, and I think the resistance to having the law enforcement interaction with the medical program, there's a history of concern and mistrust, and that might give us the opportunity as the phase-in option has been presented in other ideas, maybe we'd phase in the law enforcement participation of defining who's in the box and outside the box in the recreation side first, and then once we've established and seen it, could move over to the medical.
And Co-Chair Burdick and Representative Buckley, I hear that, and that certainly would be a potential backup. My fear would be that we would have a box that is transparent to law enforcement and a box that is not. And therefore, people that wanted to participate outside of both of those boxes would pretend to be in the one that law enforcement can't see into.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to have the song Little Boxes going through my head.
This is a very sensitive and complex area. I'm not sure we can work with this in the connection with this bill, but I'm interested in pursuing the fundamental point that you made, which is having realistic access to determine who's in and who's out on a timely basis. So I would like to pursue that line of inquiry as we move forward in 91.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry-Ellis.
Can I ask staff, what is the dash 10s? I'm hoping it's one sentence.
Madam Co-Chair, would you like me to help? I can summarize
would
in a couple
sentences. Would you please help me?
Thank you.
Sure. It basically borrows, Senator, it borrows language out of 1531 and has a clean opt-out. So it basically allows city and county governing bodies to opt out of any one or more categories of licensed marijuana businesses.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I wanted to just ask, I know a lot of committee members have been interested in the recent tragedy in Portland regarding the medical grow site, and to get your read on what happened there and how it might pertain to what we're doing here.
Sure. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andy Smith representing the city of Portland. That's why I'm sitting here, was to answer that question. Basically, what happened was you had the victims were involved in growing medical marijuana. They were holding cards for a number of patients. Their production of plants and product far outweighed their number of cards that they held, which I don't think is that uncommon, especially from law enforcement's perspective. They had a friend who had a contact in Texas who was a suspect in the case. The friend had arranged for the suspect to purchase large amounts of medical marijuana from the victims, and the suspect would travel to Portland and through the friend purchase multiple pounds of marijuana for $1,000 a pound and then FedEx it back to Texas, where he would pick it up and sell it for $7,000 a pound. The last time he made this trip, the victims weren't in a position to sell him any medical marijuana, and instead of going through the friend, he showed up at their front door. And when he showed up at their front door, he basically showed up with a wad of cash and said, "Why isn't my money good enough for you?" And the victims indicated they didn't want to deal with him in this context, and he executed them. And killed two of them and severely injured a third who survived ultimately. And there was a witness to the incident who was a patient of the growers who were murdered, who was in the area attempting to purchase product for medical purposes. So that's what I was basically told happened. You know, if there's more details you want to know, I can ask further questions.
It sounds to me, I guess the lesson for us is we now, if we pass this bill, we might have the tools to identify a grow operation like that.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, yes. I mean, I think that's the benefit of putting this regulatory structure in place. At least there's some kind of a registration and tracking system and some broad regulations in place that will help drive some of the black market activity out.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, and thank you for all your comments. That concludes our panels. I also wanted to say there was a slight glitch. I didn't realize that we had to have permission from the co-chairs to have testimony included in OLIS. The minute I found that out, I gave that permission, as did Chair Leininger. So you'll find a lot of comments from various interested parties on OLIS, and my apologies to anyone who was delayed on that. I now know the rules, so transparency is vital as we move forward on this issue. And so I encourage all of you to take a look at OLIS and see the comments that have been made. Okay, that concludes our invited testimony committee, and now it's time to rock and roll.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pozanski.
I move the Dash 6 amendment to Senate Bill 844.
Senator Pozanski has moved the Dash 6 amendment into Senate Bill 844. Is there any discussion? Are there objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pozanski.
I move the Dash 7s into Senate Bill 844.
Senator Pozanski has moved the Dash 7 amendments into Senate Bill 844. Is there any discussion? Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, not having had the time to actually look at the 7s before I got here, I'm not sure I'm that comfortable with the changing of the retention periods.
I think, 2 years?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think I would like some more time to think about that. That's a significant change.
Okay. Your objection is noted. Are there Representative Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Keep trying to do that.
I keep trying to promote.
If it'd be all right to ask a question to Senator Pozanski, since he worked on the Dash 7s, just to clarify.
Oh, absolutely.
Senator Pozanski, the concern about the investigations of home growth sites, does the Dash 7 address that issue in any way?
Yes, it does. It clarifies the intent of this committee from what I understood, which was we did not want to see investigations or inspections of home growth sites.
Thank you very much.
The key is licensed versus non-licensed, and if you're growing for yourself, you are not licensed and not subject to the regulatory requirements.
Madam Chair.
Representative Langer.
I absolutely respect the idea that Senator Cruz may not be in a position to vote on the yes on a Dash 7 right now, but I wanted to share that the rationale behind the change from 7 years to 2 years, and that was that I guess the IRS recommends that people retain their records for 7 years because that's the period in which an audit can be conducted. We, in an effort to respect people's desire that we not prescribe too much conduct, you know, that remains good business practice, good, you know, personal practice to retain records for that IRS audit period. But we thought, you know, we could just lighten up a little bit and make it a shorter period of time, which might cover an amount of time that an agency might in which an agency might choose to come in and say, hey, we don't understand this. Can you help us understand that? So that's why it was dialed back.
All right, very good, Madam Chair. The record has to be created, okay? Retention of a record takes no effort or any space. You just have it. So it's not like doing it for 7 is creating extra work. You may have to have one extra file cabinet, and that would be it. We retain records in my business for a long period of time, longer than we should actually, but that's the way my dad likes to do things. So we have more file cabinets than we need. But the thing is, once the record's created, it's there, and it's not extra work. And I just think, for the sake of caution, I think I would like to see a longer retention period.
And I think the point was also made, too, that the records will exist in OHA, and retention of records is good business practice and good personal practice by anybody. I know I personally keep all my tax records for 7 years, and I think it's wise to do that, and
I'm familiar with that problem.
I presume most people would. Okay, so are there further objections to the Dash 7 amendments? Okay, please note that Senator Cruz objects, and with that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move the Dash 10 amendments.
Well, before you do that, the Dash 7.
Well, Madam Chair, before you do that, I do struggle a little bit with the security piece of the Dash 7s with the cameras, removing all that from the processing. I mean, that's a security issue, and it's a protective issue as well. So I struggle with that.
Would you like to be entered? Would you like a? Maybe we should just do a roll call. Let's just do a roll call. This is a vote on the Dash 7 amendment.
Senator Byer?
Yes.
Representative Buckley?
Yes.
Representative Helm?
Yes.
Senator Drew?
Well, mostly, but then.
Okay, yes or no?
No. I don't think there's a mostly vote.
I know.
Vice Chair Ferriola?
No.
Vice Chair Bazanti?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Leininger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Ferrier?
Aye. The Dash 7 amendment is adopted. Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In consideration of 140 cities and 22 counties who were not as supportive, who might be after they have had opportunity to observe and learn and perhaps migrate toward the great record that will be produced by the communities who have opted in, I move the Dash 10 amendments.
Senator Farrelly has moved the Dash 10 amendments. Discussion? Senator Przanski?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I will not be able to support the Dash 10s. When we had legislation in the last session, there was an agreement that had been made as to allow for cities and counties to have an opportunity to do a moratorium. That moratorium is scheduled to expire on May 1st of this year. And based on the agreements that were made, it's time for those cities who have had over a year's period of time to accommodate their concerns to move forward. So I will not be able to support that amendment.
Further discussion. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll also be a no on the motion, just on the principle that the voters of the state have identified marijuana as a medicine, and the ability to ban access to medicine is something I don't believe is the best policy for the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair, just the fact that, yes, that, you know, a lot of cities did opt for that moratorium, and without that amendment, what we're telling them is you may have done that, but it doesn't matter now. Now we're telling you what to do. So it's a violation of an agreement if we don't allow them to continue.
Further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Byer?
No.
Representative Buckley?
No.
Representative Hunt?
No.
Senator Crew?
Yes.
Representative Bolton?
Yes.
Vice Chair Ferriola?
Aye.
Vice Chair Pisanti?
No.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Leininger?
No.
Co-Chair Ferriola?
No. The amendment has failed. Senator Przanski. We have a bill.
Madam
Chair, I'm sorry. That's right.
We're going into a. Madam Chair, I move that we.
Habit.
I move that we adjourn.
It's habit, everyone. My apologies. It's been a long day. I do keep my word. I want to thank everyone in the audience, and I want to thank the entire committee for getting us to this point. We will have a few tweaks as we convene on Monday. I don't expect anything major, and I expect to get this big piece of work on its way and turn our attention to the big kahuna, the Measure 91 implementation measure.
And, Madam Chair, where do you want us to send the transcript of our phone messages?
And with that, we are adjourned. And with that, we are adjourned.